Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can all go to every week when it's movie night. On days like today, interesting people pop in to rent something. We go through the films that they've loved across their life, and we are just here to help you figure out what you could be watching on streaming platforms and out in cinemas. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop. Did you see that thing yesterday on the TV? How's it, chaps?
Good morning.
Hi.
How you, Cole?
Great. Sorry, I was busy looking at something on the internet, and I barely noticed you come in. Hi. Let me close my laptop.
How are you, Perrin?
I'm good. How are you?
Lekker, man. It's nice to have you guys here. Oh. Another day. Another rand.
Doesn't roll off
doesn't,
the tongue, man.
Doesn't work. Hey. Thank you for all those tuning in. Today on the video store, we're going to have two very interesting guests. These are the filmmakers behind the new local comedy, Just Now Jeffrey, which is coming to cinemas, including the Bioscope from the 3rd of May, Hilton and Brett, and it's going to be a lekker chat.
Fantastic. We love local talents, skills.
No, it's cool. And this is a little time capsule. It's set in the 80s, and it's just a fun, also a coming-of-age film.
Ooh.
Just a fun comedy. Have you guys got something that can keep you guys busy?
I'm just going to open my laptop again and carry on browsing. Thanks for interrupting me.
I'll stand in the corner.
All right.
Yeah. You got to work.
You got to work, Perrin. You new to the store. We're going to...
Got to go... I think get into the storeroom and dust off the old boxes or something.
Yes, sir.
You know?
Yes, sir. Yes,
lovely.
Mr.
Cole. Go for it.
Cool. All right. Let's get into it. This is Hilton and Brett popping in to rent something. How's it, guys?
Hey, how's it, Russell?
How's it, man?
It's nice to see the two of you again in the daylight now. We had ourselves a lovely evening yesterday at the Nouveau in Rosebank to watch a special screening of your film. A special screening, not the premiere yet.
No.
Because I think we can also then talk about it. But congratulations, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I think what you guys do day to day and what you've done and achieved in your life is important to talk about. So I'd love to get into all of that. And how in amongst that, you guys have this passion project film that you've, and I want to talk about how you've created it, that we're now at the sort of tail end of almost having been done, right?
Yeah, we've climbed a mountain, and I think we didn't realize what a mountain it would be. We thought it would be a hill.
Every day Hilton are in production.
Yeah.
So I mean, it is a very normal part of your life. But have you done a feature film yet?
No. Okay. This is the first feature that we've done. We've done a bit of content, but mainly TV commercials. Brett on the ad agency side. Myself on production company as a director and owner of Bioscope Films.
Yes, so we'll want to get into that, which I think is lovely.
But yeah, I'd say, you know, when I say it's a mountain, you know, if we've been doing commercials, which are like sprints, and a movie's a marathon. I mean, it's been all-consuming for 3 years.
Yeah, it's amazing, eh?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we said it last night, but... it's something that we've wanted to do all our lives, and we've, as much as we haven't done our own feature before, we've written a lot of content, and we've always wanted to. And it's been a lifelong journey, but in particular the last 3 years.
Yeah.
It's all consuming, as you say, in a good way. You know, it's been an absolute joy for us.
Yeah.
It's kind of that marathon running is tough, but it's wonderful.
I know exactly what you're talking about, and I often use that expression because effectively, the Bioscope is an events business, whether it's a public screening or a private event. So I work in the events game, really. And friends of mine who put on like a big festival or a big day festival, they're in a sprint where they just rush up into that. Where I'm in a marathon where I've got to do this every day. Every week, the Bioscope does it. And I very much understand it's a completely different training if you were an athlete. It's a very different way of going about your life. So it's interesting that you've now been doing sprints
and marathons
at the same time, because effectively, I would imagine the day today still has to continue, right?
Yes.
You weren't necessarily able to put it on hold.
Step back for a bit. Certainly, I did direct a few commercials before and after the shooting of Just Now, Jeffrey, but during production, I didn't. And Brett also.
Yeah, that was always our commitment is, we wanted to do this thing for so long that when we finally got to do it, we were going to do it all in.
Okay.
So I took a sabbatical. Gilt paused his commercials directing. Well, I say sabbatical. That would imply I got paid, which I didn't. But we were always going to be all in. And yeah, it's incredible. I mean, just on that note about the marathon, we marvel at this, and it'll be interesting for our advertising colleagues to hear. But, the working on set 6 days a week, 16 hours a day, we had thought that, a three-day shoot was a hell of a thing. But the process and the commitment and the craft of that team of people running that marathon every day is extraordinary.
Yeah.
It was absolutely amazing for us to see.
So I think the most important thing to mention at this point is what the it is. As you just said, the film is called Just Now, Jeffrey.
Yes.
And we'll get into the story and the context, which I think is very fun and endearing.
We'll get into it just now, Russell.
But
just now, Russell.
There's just now, there's now, and there's now. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, so perhaps, Brett, for yourself, you're in advertising.
Yeah.
Okay, and you are with Draft FCB, hey?
So with Nahana Communications Group, of which FCB is a part.
Okay.
But yeah, pretty much been a lifer there for the better part of kind of 25 years.
I did my time.
Yeah.
I was at Saatchi Joburg for 2 years.
Okay.
I very much put my head under the water, got a sense of it, realized I kind of wanted to be my own boss.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed it. I got it. I'm glad I did it.
We say this all the time. It's definitely a love hate with advertising. We love lots about it, and particularly the people and the craft. It taught us our craft. So I started as a copywriter.
Okay.
And it really, it helped us hone our craft, meet amazing craftspeople.
Yeah.
And then finally get to the point where we could, put all that experience into the movie.
But creativity is a muscle. I know also with myself as a musician, like the more you think, the more you have to think creatively, the better that muscle gets flexed. And so having to make those kind of creative decisions, whether it's for nappies or like face cream, will exercise your muscle when you can then now apply it to your own film. So I'm sure all of that fed in, right?
Absolutely. I mean, and particularly from a production point of view, which is obviously Hilt's side of the process, but it was, we literally, he was sitting there going, which technique could we use that I've learned along the way?
Well, that's the thing, it's, we're kind of nervous about doing a feature film, having never done one before, but it came so easily because, I've probably directed over 300 commercials over the past 20 years.
Yeah.
And even the ones that were tough or irritating or whatever, you always learn something.
Totally.
So, with Brett, I'd say, you remember that shot we did on a Toyota ad, where the guy walks and we contra-zoomed and let's do one of those.
Contra-zoomed.
Just from working with kids and animals and knowing how to put actors at ease.
Whole other thing. I met a guy whose job was to be like the kid minder on set. He came from a psychology perspective.
Mm.
And that somehow got him the strange job where he was the kid that sort of kept the child happy on set, like a toddler.
Child. Yeah, that's a big part of it. We didn't
the child handling.
We didn't have anybody that young. Fortunately.
Yeah, no,
well,
there was
Seppo, who was about 8 or 9.
For him.
He was a cute kid in the film. He acted well.
It was great.
But you two have been friends your whole life, eh?
No. Since we were 12.
But I mean,
we didn't meet as babies.
But I mean, okay. So the formative years, and I think this is quite important because the film that you guys have ended up making, Just Now, Jeffrey, very much centers around the high school adolescence experience in the 80s, which was an interesting minefield to be in, and specifically a Jewish 80s in South Africa.
Yes.
Which I thought was a lovely perspective. And we've, you know, we've heard the buzzword so often, and it comes out in speeches at film festivals where everyone says, tell you, you know, we must tell our stories, and we all have stories. And I was just so glad when watching it where I was like, this is authentically someone's story.
Yeah.
Sure, it's made fun and you've got extra comical characters, but at the heart of it, we've got Jeffrey. He's a high school kid who's...
He wants to get laid.
Sure. He's got the sort of politics.
It's a simple premise.
Very simple premise.
He's got the politics of South Africa in the background, his Jewish household as his kind of context. And I just thought it was lovely.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's a classic coming-of-age story where two guys make a pact to lose their virginities before the end of the year. Now, we've seen that kind of thing before, but we've never seen it with our voice and our tone and our setting. And part of that is, you know, we grew up watching movies like American Pie or Stand By Me, shows like The Wonder Years, and we thought, well, we've never seen us up there as white, Jewish, South Africans, and it's kind of normalizing our youths by putting it on screen, because it's never been done before, not with our voice.
Well, yeah, and a lovely point of that context was South Africa's conservatism. Which, even though I was born mid-80s, still saw a lot of. But, I mean, I know an era older than me, like, it was almost impossible to get your hands on...
anything.
On anything,
you know?
It was
highly illegal. I mean... the magazines would have stars covering the girls' breasts.
Yeah, and the joke was always that when sort of South African men went to a sort of Italian beach, they just assumed that every woman had stars.
Them. Yeah, we always, I mean, that was something that we wanted to weave in. We found it fascinating, the idea of these very conservative people sitting in a room watching this explicit material to decide whether South Africans could see the stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's so fascinating.
So, yeah, you know, sort of super conservative people probably getting off watching it. And there's a scene that sort of deals with the censorship board, and they're kind of hating it but loving it and watching it but banning it.
Yeah. No, and I thought that was fun. And then, of course, the other part of the story is how these kids are making the money, because they've realized that one way in which they can ensure that they get laid is if they were to pay for it. So then the movie turns into like a fun hustle and all the characters involved in that. I guess what were some of the things in your own life that you took to the film? I mean, when someone sees it, obviously there's going to be a multitude of characters and moments, but were any of that inspired by...
It's a work of fiction, and any similarities to persons living or dead is purely coincidental.
But any sort of moments that you drew from, or any characters?
Yeah,
because I think that's, you know, earlier we were talking about going into where you grew up and renting the videos, and of course in this film there's a video store. And
yeah, I mean, there are people in there that are a mishmash of inspiration from people we knew. You know, no one is exactly based on
one
person.
No, of course, but I mean, I'm just curious, who were some of those people?
Yeah, no, it's pure fiction. We're going to keep repeating that, according to our attorneys. No, but the truth is, it is an amalgamation. And we wanted to your earlier point, make it very personal. So we wanted to write about characters and types of people that we knew. So it is drawing on all of those characters that we grew up with, and, you know, pulled bits of fact and fiction out of the mix of our lives. But, obviously, like, Tarantino is not a crazy slave owner, you know, where this is also fiction.
Sure. Yeah.
There were parts that inspired us. So, you know, we built this sort of texture and canvas around these kids growing up, kind of like we grew up. And then there were a few what-ifs. And there were a couple of things that we remember actually happening. The one that did happen to us was a rugby game that erupted due to anti-Semitism. We were in that match, and it turned into a brawl where parents got involved, siblings got involved. It made the newspaper.
Oh, hectic.
So we always thought, you know, that was a really interesting part of our history that we want to do. Kind of put in a movie one day.
Yeah.
And then there was also this crazy thing that happened in the 80s that some people still remember. And I don't want to give away any sort of spoilers, but there was live porn broadcast on TV at the SABC. Somebody screwed up, and somehow for a minute it was on air.
Yeah.
And it was a huge scandal. Like, firstly, porn was illegal. Secondly, the SABC only had one channel, and it probably broadcast for 2 or 3 hours a day. Mm. But some dude was probably making copies in the back room, and somehow it went live.
Yeah.
And it was on the in the papers. Everyone was talking. Like, a lot of older people still remember that. And we're like, how did that happen? You know, what's the backstory? And that was like just a bit of inspiration for us to build a narrative about what may have happened there.
Not to give too much away, but I could see how that could have been a lovely seed to have been planted in the in the in the film.
Yeah.
Lovely. And so where are we at now? You still doing some final touches? You mentioned you're still trying to figure out some of the music rights.
Yeah.
And then can one say anything at this point about what the hopes and dreams are for the film?
Yeah. As long as nobody holds us to an exact date. But we are in final sort of stages of conversations with Steve Kinnicker, which is exciting.
Cool.
We do need to, we're doing a bunch of snags. As much as that version you saw last night probably felt mostly fine, there's probably like a dozen things that we need to clean up.
Sure.
So there's the small touches, there's the music licensing. Mm-hmm. We may have to shift or change some of the tracks, but those are all kind of small tweaks to hopefully pretty close to where it is right now.
Because, yeah, you mentioned that at the beginning, so I was then conscious of listening out to what songs you were choosing. Yeah. And I turned to our friend Fausto and I said, ooh, Dire Straits might be kind of tricky. It's perfect in that moment. And here's hoping it's possible or you find something better.
Yeah,
but it was one of those where I was like, I could see why you chose Money for Nothing in that one scene. And I was like, that might not be the cheapest thing to license.
Exactly. I mean, it's a very, very ambitious track list. But we wanted to put it together. And then we're now negotiating and seeing what we can afford. We also have found a lot of South African music from the 80s, which will be in the next version, in the next cut.
Good.
Which is really great because there's some fantastic tracks and it's just taken a bit of time to find the right fit.
No,
because
and perhaps finding the owners of that also could be quite tricky because the old South African 80s bands can be anywhere in the world or any form of alive or dead.
Yeah, we found most of the rights are with publishers like Universal or Sony or Gresham. Yeah. But where it gets tricky is whether it's just for South Africa or whether it's for international, whether it's for cinema or whether it's for TVOD or SVOD or AVOD. So there's a whole world of
you've
stuff.
Got to license it in each way.
Yeah.
Correct, yeah.
Interesting, hey. Sure. One thing we touched on right at the start is that the production company that you're a part of is called Bioscope.
Yes.
And I would love to just take a moment because I think it's a fun, interesting touch points of how our two very different businesses have been sort of weirdly linked over the years.
Yeah, it's crazy. So I started Bioscope in 2005 with Daniel Kaplan, my business partner. And it was out of a love of going to the Bioscope. I mean, that's how we got the name. For me, it's like, what are you doing tonight? Let's go to the Bioscope. You know, it's a very South African thing to go to the Bioscope. And I think still we had a partner at the time. And he said in townships, they still call it Bioscope, and it's still referred to as that. And it's just, it's like Christmas. Let's go to Bioscope. It's a fantastic word. Yeah. I think the origin's actually from a German projector, which is a Bioscope, which is
Bioscope, which was a more mobile setup.
Exactly.
From what I could at some point figure out. Okay.
So we started the production company called Bioscope, and then we're starting in phone calls. I think it was, when did you start? In 2009?
In 2010.
2010.
Yeah.
Dan would get these phone calls. Hi, what time's this showing? Or what's this? And he goes, no. This is a film production company. You know, send us advertising scripts. We'll shoot them. And then we got wind of some guy has started a place called the Bioscope. So we thought, all right, before we get lawyers' letters and legal, let's find out who this guy is and what he's on about. And we immediately resonated with what you were doing, and it's independent cinema, and it's where our heart is. And just walking in here today, like all of your artifacts and everything in the video store, it's all the stuff I love.
Yeah.
So,
So we were two film students with a dream, and I've mentioned this before, and my business partner wrote his thesis at the end of WITS about whether or not there was space for an independent cinema in Johannesburg. And we were throwing around words like cinematheque. You know, we were a bit pretentious. And of course, that's quite a difficult word to spell, especially if you want someone to type it in. And then at one point it just dawned on me, and I remember phoning him saying, like, the word bioscope has to be in it. Come on. Like, it's not a word that was on any of our radars in my generation, but I was like, we're doing this research, we're finding out about the gem bioscopes and these old bioscopes. It's got to be, we got to tell the history of the bioscopes. We got to continue that.
Yeah.
And I think we were originally going to be in a location in Newtown. So the original plan was to be called the Newtown Bioscope. Then that fell through, and then I realized the domain thebioscope.co.za was available, and we thought, okay, well, let's be the bioscope, because if anyone else wants to open up another bioscope, we'll always be the bioscope. Started at logos, getting it ready, and then I spotted your company. I thought, oh fuck. And then I'd already trademarked something else in my life. So I looked at whether or not you had it trademarked, or what kind of trademark did exist, to find out that you can't trademark the word bioscope. And then I thought, okay, well, I'm sure we'll be fine, because we're a bioscope. They make films. I'm sure we'll be fine. And then a few years in, I got a mail from Daniel that was just like, I think we need to talk. I was like, oh no, what's this conversation going to be like? And then you realize he's a lovely dude.
Yeah.
And he explained the story of how your receptionist is oftentimes kept a copy of the schedule. Every now and again, we also get a mail of someone going like, here's my invoice. And of course you freak out and you're like, what is this?
So have you started a production company on the side?
And then we realize, no. You know, wrong company.
Now, catering, 200,000 rand, what the hell's
this? Yeah, it's like a grip, or, you know, extra hours or something. And then, yeah, we reached this, it was nice to actually just meet.
Yeah.
And then we reached a lovely consensus, which was that, you know, we will always just say independent cinema wherever possible in our name and our logos. And we'll just try and keep those two quite clearly defined.
Yeah.
And it was great. And then there was one time when the bioscope was at the bioscope.
We shot
a like Black Label commercial or something. And it was so fun to just go bioscope at bioscope.
Yeah.
And we've got one of your, so on the roads, if there's a commercial, it's someone's job to put up like little temporary signs which tell everyone involved where the set is.
Yeah.
Someone picked up a bioscope one and said, oh, I thought you guys would like this. And so we've got it behind the bar. I don't know whether you spotted it.
I didn't. I'll have a look on the
way out. It's in amongst all the bottles and the clutter behind the bar. So it is lovely, and it's so nice that our businesses have sort of shared, I think, a very similar sense of nostalgia. And
love of movies.
Absolutely. And I think that was always very clear.
Yeah.
And then it was obviously very clear that thankfully we can exist very harmoniously side by side.
And hopefully we can screen Bioscope's first feature film here at some point in the near future.
It would be lovely.
Yeah.
Cool, guys. So I think one thing that we like to do here is to go through the films that you've loved. And I think especially knowing that your friendship started around 12, that this has been a passion project you've always wanted to make, knowing what this film is about, I think it could be quite cool to journey through our lives a bit.
Sure.
And see the films that kind of helped shape you along the way.
Yeah.
Where did we both grow up?
I grew up in Krugersdorp, but I moved to Joburg when I was 10. So I was.
Do you not consider Joburg Krugersdorp?
No.
It was a journey, man.
West Rand, yeah, man.
It's the same place.
No, when we were in the Dorp, people go, oh, we're going to town. Oh, you know. And there were no cinemas in Krugersdorp, so the closest was Flora Center, or otherwise, if it was a real big day out, you'd go to Sandton. But yeah, no, we never considered. We were Dorpies, you know, like
Krugersdorp.
Yeah,
and
played
obviously,
rugby barefoot.
Jewish, hey? Jewish household.
Yes.
So a lot of those, like, Pesach rituals and those kinds of that family environment comes through in the movie. And yourself, Brett?
So I'm from the real Joburg, the real big city, born and bred, not far from here actually, Park Lane Clinic.
Okay, I think I was also born in Park Lane.
Oh, really? Hey?
Yeah.
So I've pretty much been in this 5 kilometer radius for my entire life, but actually had cousins in Krugersdorp. So funnily enough, even though Hilton and I didn't know each other, we were hanging out on the same turf as youngsters, but only met in primary school. Yeah.
So we have a because what we do at the Video Store is we talk about your four great loves, which are the films that come to you at these four key points in your life. The first one is your puppy love film, which is kind of nursery school, primary school, your first kind of, for some people, it's their first time they ever went to cinemas. It doesn't have to be a cinema experience, but is there a film that you could think that perhaps kind of came to you first?
Well, my puppy love film was Psycho.
Ooh, lordy.
Yeah, it scared the shit out of me. I remember watching it as a kid with my mother. So my mother still loves movies, and she had let me stay up late if I'd watch a movie with her. And that's where my love really began. So we'd watch the old MGM classics, and one night we watched Psycho.
Jesus.
It scared the fucking hell out of me. I didn't sleep for weeks. It absolutely terrified me, but I was fascinated with it, and I had to learn how it was made.
Yeah.
Because I thought, if I can demystify it, if I can just convince myself that there was a crew and a camera there and the blood wasn't real and Norman Bates was actually an actor, maybe I'd get to sleep at night, because I wasn't sleeping. I was lying in a cold sweat in my bed. And I've subsequently read every single book about Psycho. I know absolutely everything about that movie. And I think I always loved films, but that scared me so much that the only way to fix that was to learn how it was made, so I wouldn't be scared anymore.
And that's very interesting, because obviously a very famous Alfred Hitchcock film. He was, and always has been, known to be the very meticulous filmmaker, where he's, maybe you can speak to this with all the research that you did, but he was the first filmmaker, at least in my opinion, or in my understanding, that really knew the buttons and the science of filmmaking, where it was like, you have this, that leads to this, almost to the point where it could be a bit cold.
Yeah.
But he knew how to manipulate the audience.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, he did a ton of silent films. So he had done his 20,000 hours. He had done hundreds and hundreds of movies before any of them became well known. And he was a great technician. He understood lensing and lighting. But there were a lot of people don't know about him, and we've got him to thank for this, is in 1960, when Psycho came out, he changed the way that movies were seen in cinemas.
Okay.
Up until then, you could go in at any time. And I remember my dad would tell me about this. You could buy a ticket and you could walk in at any point and you could stay as long as you wanted. And then you'd leave.
Okay.
So it was on a rotation. There were no screening times. And obviously the exhibitors liked this because people could buy.
Interesting. And with Psycho, almost like, that was like a tea room concept, hey? Because I heard about tea room bioscopes, where it was like you go on your lunch break.
Yeah, you just go
in. You arrive at any point, you just watch the movie.
Yeah, and most people would watch it. So they walked in 20 minutes into the film, they'd watch it until it looped around to the point that they saw, and then they'd leave, which is absolutely horrific to think of. I mean, as a storyteller, it's mad. And Hitchcock, he had enough power in 1960 to say, that's it, okay? People will not be admitted after the movie starts. Okay. And there are big posters of him saying this, and there was a huge uproar, and it changed the way film was watched in cinemas around the world.
Because
obviously he didn't want people to know the twist or the surprise. He wanted them to see it from the beginning to the end, and he changed everything. Yeah. Up until then, thanks, Alf.
Psycho very famously had what, I think he coined the term MacGuffin?
Was it
Hitchcock? I don't know.
Well, I don't know whether he coined it, but it existed as an idea, which was that, you know, you think this film is about one thing,
but it's,
and then you're going to, it's going to change.
Yeah.
So it starts as this kind of money, like robbery thriller, and everything is fine, and a young Hilton is not going to have nightmares until all of a sudden this woman is massacred in the shower.
Janet Leigh was a massive star. She was as big as it got then. She was like a Julia Roberts or Cameron Diaz.
Yeah, this is Jamie Lee Curtis's mom,
yes,
right?
Yes, correct. And she was a big star, so people would flock to go see her in a movie. So there they are watching this kind of film noir, as you say, sex, money, and boom, she gets tired, she turns off into a motel and gets killed, dead, 20 minutes into the film.
And everyone probably checks their watches and goes, what are we going to be watching for the rest of this?
Now we're stuck with the psycho, Norman Bates, and we've got nowhere to go. So the story changes into a horror, which is still an amazing technique to do. You know?
It's a bold move.
Yeah.
Magic. Okay, and for you, Brett?
Jeez, yeah, I think
it doesn't have to be as film schooly.
No, mine's on the opposite side of the continuum. I was staying the hell away from that kind of stuff. I don't think I would have been psychologically well if I went through what Hilt went through.
It explains a lot.
Exactly. The stuff that we were all drawn to, but in particular, in the formative years, was stuff like Mel Brooks.
Okay.
You know, I really loved that sort of absurd comedy, the Zucker Brothers as well. I mean, there was an era of these comedic filmmakers who really, you know, pushed the boundaries of what was allowable. And it's interesting how, you know, some of the stuff that they did back in that day would be, I think, seen as very, very edgy today. In fact, unacceptable in a lot of instances.
Well, who was I talking to? I think I was talking to Dan, your business partner, yesterday about screening some of these old films at the Bioscope. And he's like, you should do News of the World and maybe Blazing Saddles. Although, I don't know, because a film like Blazing Saddles is being relooked in 2024 and questioning whether or not it's right.
Yeah,
and whether or not it should be cancelled. But I can't remember the film well enough, but I know that it was a bold conversation about racism, but it was probably on the... I can't speak on it, but I think it was...
Yeah, I would definitely look at it before you screen it and screen it with a warning. But I think, it, like all great comedy, it was doing it in a way that wasn't, you know, necessarily being racist. It was addressing the racism in a very funny way.
Bringing it to the surface, yeah.
And I think some audiences are not comfortable with that these days, but I don't think there's anything wrong with going down that path and screening that kind of movie. But I was always fascinated by those kinds of films and, you know, the absurdity of the Zucker Brothers type movie. And you spoke earlier about, you know, walking into the video shop. We had one in particular, well, there were a couple, but one in Parktown North, which specialized in like British comedy, or where you would get a bootleg copy of a film like Top Secret.
Okay.
And it's not necessarily the film that you thought was the greatest film, but you watched it so many times.
Yeah.
You started absorbing it by osmosis.
Yeah.
I must have watched Top Secret. I'd come home from school, stick the old VHS in, sit and eat my lunch and watch that film over
and over. I don't
know
Top Secret.
Again.
Sorry.
It's a spoof. It's like the guys who did Airplane and Flying High. It's with Val Kilmer. And I haven't seen it for a long time, but
I know. Look, I probably haven't seen it in a couple of decades.
I think it's important to mention at that point that you gravitated to this humor because the passion project that you two have chosen to make is 150% about comedy.
Yeah,
I mean that's really what you were shooting for. You wanted to make a comedy. I mean, you have. So comedy was obviously a big part of your life in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, we grew up watching those movies over and over again, going to school, referencing them 1,000 times a day, you know, pulling out the little sound bites and the lines that we loved.
Mm.
You know, Fawlty Towers, you know, you were saying earlier, not necessarily a movie.
No.
Fawlty Towers is another great example where we wore those VHSs down to threads. And it was the most brilliantly crafted script writing.
The British stuff. It's all in the writing.
John Cleese and Prunella Scales wrote it together. But they spent like 12 weeks writing each episode.
And a little bit like Mr. Bean, you think there's so many, but there's just a limited series.
It's interesting that you say that we chose to make a comedy, and it is. I suppose if you define it, it is a comedy. But I remember we were talking to the actors, two of our brilliant actors, Julian and Dino, who played Jeffrey and Brad. And we're like, they're like, this is quite hectic what these kids go through. And I'm like, well, you know, it could actually be a horror movie because, you know, they land up in a situation. He's got this uncle who's kind of living in his room, again, not wanting to spoil things. Then the bad guy comes and they get threatened and there's violence and there's blackmail. And it is a comedy, but, you know, it also deals with teenage horrors and adolescence
and hormones
and all the sort of things you've got to go through.
Yeah, it's that classic chirp from John. I think John Cleese said it, you know, comedy is a serious business.
Yeah.
And when we set out to do this, you know, we wanted to write something that was incredibly compelling and then the layer of comedy weaves in. But you don't try and make it funny. You write a great story and then add that.
Sometimes the humor comes from someone taking it very seriously.
Sure.
And I think for our main character, who's not just trying to get laid, but he's trying to survive because he could be killed because people need him, you know, to raise a certain amount of money and things are on the line. Like he was very serious.
Yeah.
Like he's not in a comedy.
No, and the same with
he's in a nightmare.
You know, he's in somewhat of a nightmare.
The same with the villain, the bad guy, the villain whose name's Willem, because it sounded like villain, played by Rob Van Furen.
Let me tell you, he nailed it.
Yeah, and we kept saying to him, you know, because Rob's a great comedic actor, and we said Willem is deadly serious about what he's doing. Yes, he looks funny and he sounds funny, but his intentions are dark and bad.
Yeah,
he's a bad man.
No, and that's one of the interesting notes I remember getting from early varsity days or acting, I forget it was an acting class. I remember someone pointing out, like, you don't act drunk, you've got to act sober. Because that's what happens when you're drunk.
You try to pretend that you're sober.
A true person who's drunk is someone who is drunk who's trying to be sober. So, yeah, it's funny that if you are just being deadly, deadly serious, the comedy comes through that. Okay, so now we're in high school. That's probably then around when you guys met. Did you go to the same high school?
Yeah, we did.
And where? Which school was that?
King David Victory Park.
All right. Just down the road. Lovely. Yeah. Okay, so now we're in this the kind of zone of just now Jeffrey.
Yes.
Did you at that point even start thinking about a story or a film together?
No, we were living it.
We were just living it. And what films were you guys watching at that point?
For me, I mean, all the films. You know, we absolutely adore and love films and consume them. And Brett and I go to the video shop together and we'd rent movies for the weekend and watch them all. But for me, as you say, high school, I'd say Rocky. Rocky was a huge film for me. I absolutely loved Rocky. I'd watch it over and over and over. And for a number of reasons, mainly because it's the underdog, which is a great, great story. You know, everybody knows it. I don't need to tell you that. The other thing is it inspired me to get fit. It inspired me to get into shape. I was like quite a unfit.
Did you have a little bit of extra?
A little bit. But, you know, Sly got me to hit the gym and that was, I just had to put on that scene and watch that. I remember
you had that poster in your room.
Yeah.
It was Rocky III, I think.
Yeah.
And that was your kind of inspiration.
And then as I got older, what I really, really appreciate and admire about Rocky is the backstory to that film.
Yeah.
You know, Stallone was broke. He was penniless. He had absolutely nothing. He wrote the script. Hollywood liked it. I think they offered him $100,000 or $200,000, and they wanted James Caan or Burt Reynolds or Paul Newman to play the part. And he was like, absolutely not. You know, it's got to be me. Mm. And they were like, no, what? You're not an actor. You got a funny lip. You're nobody. Yeah. And he stuck to it. And eventually they said, okay, we'll give you $1 million budget. You got to shoot it in 18 days.
Yeah.
And he did it. He did a brilliant job. And actually another story out of that restriction is where the Steadicam actually got discovered. For Rocky, because they couldn't afford to have cranes and dollies and tracking shots when he runs and also in the ring. So you got to watch behind the scenes. You see the guy who operates what's a very crude, rudimentary Steadicam. He's like 6'6", and he's moving faster than Stallone as he runs next to him with this. And that's really kind of where the Steadicam began.
For those not in the world, the Steadicam is something mobile, but it needs to be steady, as opposed to this feeling of it being handheld.
Exactly. It's but it's got the smooth motion of a track or a dolly. But it's weighted and it's counterweighted with it's a very complex.
Yeah. So. Now it's a whole rig that almost looks like this kind of science fiction exoskeleton that someone wears. And of course, you know that those guys have got like the strongest but perhaps the most fucked up backs because that's what they do for a living. But okay, so they invented it for that. No, and then of course, the film didn't just go on to do well. I mean, it won Oscars.
Yeah.
And so it was a real amazing story. I haven't finished watching the Sylvester Stallone Netflix thing. Did you watch it?
Tulsa King.
No, there was a biopic about him.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was just called Stallone or Sylvester or Sly.
Great. Sly.
Okay, it's just called Sly. Yeah, we call this film the High School Crush, where, you know, it could just be pushing you to be something more or opening or breaking open your brain or perhaps being a bit dangerous, you know, like in high school you do try and find boundaries.
Yeah.
Okay, so for you it brought you a bit closer to fitness and sort of
and the underdog
having
and
you,
it's a
having
love
you
story.
Believe you can achieve. Brett, for you over in high school?
Yeah, as Hilt says, a lot of the same films. I was just thinking while you guys were chatting about Rocky, you know, Paradise Alley, which was also another brilliant film. In fact, he wrote a novel. I don't know if you know that. He wrote a novel, bashed it out because he couldn't get the film made.
Who's this?
Stallone.
Stallone, okay.
And then that was the precursor to Rocky. So he was such a diligent... I only discovered this after the fact, but my brothers and I were kind of obsessed with that film. And the Rockies. As Hilt said, we used to go to the video store. We were talking about this last night. There's so much content, brilliant TV and film these days that you kind of take it for granted.
Yeah.
Just,
yeah.
It's
no,
such
totally.
A tragedy.
Yeah.
We'd go to the video store, you'd walk out with a stack of five tapes, And you'd sit in a weekend and watch 2, 3, 4 films.
Yeah.
So what was Paradise Alley?
So it was a novel that Stallone wrote and then turned into a movie about... Okay. It was also kind of an underdog story. Yeah. I think it was his practice run for Rocky, basically.
Oh, so he made that before Rocky?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it only got released afterwards, I think.
Okay. Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
But I remember high school movie. I have such a clear memory of Brett and I in 1985 going to see Back to the Future together.
Just we talked about that for days.
Days. And we went to Hyde Park. We sat there. I love the back row of the second front section. And we were, but hang on. If you went back to 1955 and the DeLorean was hidden and then he went back again,
if his past self is there and he meets himself, how does, hours.
So that was in cinema.
Yeah. I remember walking. Yeah, we loved that movie. And
it's timeless.
It is.
It's an
amazing. Apparently, UCLA use it as the perfect, the film school there use it as the perfect example of a film, because it hits all the right points. It's got all the right arcs.
Okay, the first one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Did you hear the story about The Godfather, where Mario Puzo, who wrote the book, then put the screenplay together, and then he thought, Jesus, I don't really know what I'm doing. I should perhaps go to film school. And apparently, he sat in film school and the lecturer was like, we're going to study The Godfather.
Oh, wow.
And he was like, it was made by someone who doesn't know how to do the job. Okay, so UCLA use...
Back to the Future.
Yeah. The Bioscope, I think it's in the second one when they go into the future, we coordinated a screening because that date was... 2015 or something, which was hoverboards. We're still waiting on the hoverboards. But the Bioscope did a screening which was timed perfectly so that he arrives at the exact moment. It was like a South Africa. It was like a bizarre point in the afternoon. Yeah. It was like 4 or 5, but it was a nice.
I don't know if you noticed in just now, Jeffrey. There's a character Finkelstein who owns a video shop.
Yes,
and he's always talking about movies, and it's like our kind of nod to the movies we loved.
Mm.
But a little Easter egg there is that he's always in the wardrobe of a well-known character from an 80s film. So when he's talking about Back to the Future, he's wearing Marty McFly's jacket. And cool, then he's wearing Ferris Bueller's outfit. And
then at one point I was noticing he was wearing the black leather.
Yes.
That was...
With the sunglasses. What's that? Risky Business.
Risky Business, yeah.
That's lovely. Okay, great. Okay, now we are into the more varsity, early job, career part of our lives. We call this the It's Getting Serious film. Did we study? What did we do after high school?
We both went to WITS.
Nice.
Brett did architecture for a year.
Didn't quite make a year. I lasted 6 months.
Six is hard, eh?
2 days.
I lasted 6 months.
It's one of the hardest degrees.
Yeah.
It's often makes the list in terms of how much extra work you need to do.
Yeah, my brother actually did it before me. He lasted 2 years and said, whatever you do, don't do this degree. And I was like, yeah, whatever, I'll do it. And then lasted 6 months.
Okay.
And then, we both were there at the same time. We did BAs.
Nice.
Then landed up at AAA School of Advertising.
Cool.
Then I went off to film school and Brett started his illustrious and brilliant career in advertising.
Which film school did you go to?
London Film School.
Oh, lovely.
Which I was very lucky, but bear in mind back then it was 4 rand to the pound. So so studying in London was doable.
Yeah.
And Fran was with me and she actually worked at an ad agency and she earned the money while I studied film. And
This is your now wife.
Yes.
You met in London or you went over together?
We met in high school.
Okay, lovely.
All and the people I'm close to. I didn't really expand
Doesn't like change, really.
No. I met them at 12, 14, best friend, wife. That's
lovely, man. Okay, so you guys both went over to London together.
Yeah.
She was able to make a little bit of bread while I followed your dreams.
Exactly. Okay. And I'd say the movie for... just thinking about those last 2 years. I mean, there are two that spring to mind. And it would be True Romance, which I know you're screening tonight.
Yes.
And Pulp Fiction. But if I had to choose, I'd say True Romance. It's just because we had never seen anything like that. I mean, the sophisticated plot and the characters. And I think we referenced True Romance a lot when we were writing just now, Jeffrey, because we love those characters who just come in for one scene. You know, Gary Oldman as Drexel. You got James Gandolfini's in there. I mean, it's... Yeah. And you just see them once or twice, but they make it so much richer. And
even Christopher Walken as well, yeah.
And Dennis Hopper, Christopher.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you got a lovely scene with Lo Fenta.
Yeah.
And in that moment, not to give too much away, you've got Corne and Twaki united
exactly.
In that scene, obviously, with very different characters. But yeah, that moment and that freedom and that playfulness is fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's been a tradition at the Bioscope to always screen True Romance on Valentine's. It's just what's perfectly embodied the sensibility of the Bioscope, and we'll stop doing it when we stop selling out.
And, and you're sold out tonight, right?
Yeah, both screenings, which is lovely. So
I think it's a perfect way to spend Valentine's. In fact, it's the only way I can possibly think of.
Yeah, but a part of me kind of secretly hopes there'll at least be one couple where one of them booked the tickets and didn't read the description.
Thinks perhaps, it's a rom-com.
And perhaps the girl is sort of clenching, you know, like the arm of her partner going, babe, what are we watching? Because there's blood in a suitcase of cocaine and everybody dies. It's great.
That's great.
Apparently it was meant to, in its very early draft, be a prequel to Natural Born Killers.
Hmm.
I don't know whether you knew that.
No. But I can see the parallels.
The two, and then of course now with Natural Born Killers, you've now got this kind of outlaw couple on the on the run.
I rewatched Natural Born Killers recently. I remember loving it at the time. It's so heavy-handed.
I wasn't sure whether it deserved a rewatch. Did you struggle?
Yeah, I mean, I wish Tarantino would have directed it because Oliver Stone just went all MTV on it. And
yeah, that's right. There's all that different color.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit of a visual assault, eh?
Yeah.
I think he overcooked it.
What was your varsity movie?
Also early work, sort of around that time. It's when the relationships were getting more serious.
Yeah, so Tarantino, that was the era of Tarantino, and we discovered him and I think fell in love with a different kind of filmmaking we'd never seen before and a kind of dark, comedic storytelling that we'd never seen before. And in fact, I had a kind of a crossing of paths with Pulp Fiction because... we had the state clinical account at the agency when I was a junior. And Pulp Fiction was premiering in South Africa. This must have been 1995, I guess.
Yeah.
And they had a competition in the agency to write the radio ad to announce the launch of Pulp Fiction.
Okay. So had you seen the film?
No, so this is the story. So came up with an idea, and then if you won the competition, you got to go see the premiere of Pulp Fiction before it came out in cinemas.
How hard is it to write the copy for a film you haven't seen?
I guess
all you had to go on was the trailer, hey?
Yeah, it was a kind of a broad concept just to see. And then we ended up redoing it after the screening.
Okay.
But that was kind of, I guess life-changing in some sense because there was so much hype around that movie and I felt like I got the special moment. You know, it was a cinema of like, a dozen people.
Wait, so you won?
Yes, I won the competition.
Important part of the story. What was the concept of your ad?
It was actually quite bad, now that I think about it.
Okay,
So, in fact, yes, the point was they had to write the ad, that we had to get the ad done, you know, like weeks before the film arrived. So you were writing it with an idea of what the movie was about. Mm. So it was a kind of a metaphor. I'm not going to bore you with the idea, but...
I remember you did a bit of direct marketing as well. It was that I thought was brilliant. You did
I'd forgotten about that.
I remember his work better than he does.
That was actually a great idea.
Syringe,
yeah, so there was a press kit, and it was a syringe filled with fake blood, but that was a pen. So they got to. We sent the media the pen to say, "Would you like to come and sign here if you'd like to come and see this?"
Well, the
film.
Line was rushed to see it.
Damn it. How does he remember this?
Yeah, so the term is direct marketing when it's when it's an idea for something that you send directly to press or people as opposed to a billboard which isn't direct. It's something you see in your periphery or TV. Okay.
The radio, mainstream media.
It's all coming back to me. Okay, well, that must have been fun. And then you obviously then got the chance to watch the movie. And so that obviously stuck out for you as a nice early work film.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, it was something that we were all, you know, waiting to see, and you know, we was lucky enough to see it then, and we watched it 100 times afterwards. Yeah. And I think that definitely Tarantino's films we've watched so many times and marvelled at.
Yeah.
You know what the boundaries he pushed. That's definitely part of the DNA of.
Freedom of that storytelling where halfway through you're like, okay, now it's a pocket watch, and you're like, the chapters of the pocket watch, and you're like, and then of course what was also genius was getting Travolta to dance. It's such a like simple thing, but you know, he came out of Saturday Night Fever and Staying Alive, and everybody knew him as this particular kind of guy who also danced.
Yeah. There's a fantastic story about Tarantino, how he cast him, and Bruce Willis. So you're absolutely right. You know, everybody had kind of written Travolta off, and Tarantino saw in him the perfect character to play Vince, and he had cast him. And then Bruce Willis got wind of the script and came to Tarantino's house and basically took him aside. You know, Bruce Willis was one of the godfathers of Hollywood.
Yeah, big dog.
Took Tarantino aside and said, listen, I want to play Vincent. And Tarantino, you know, incredible, you know, dedication to his vision. He said, listen, Travolta's the right guy for that role. Sorry.
Yeah.
But actually, there's this other character, and I want you to go, I'd love you to reread it. And there's this character, Butch, that I think you'd be amazing for.
Mm.
And, he's, you know, it's not like there's one main character. There's amazing characters throughout this film. And Bruce Willis went away and said, yeah, just, I love it. I'll do it.
Yeah.
But, the fact that he is so singular about his vision and can see the potential of a Travolta dancing in the way that he did is remarkable.
Whether you knew it or not, like, there was the charm to sort of seeing him dance again.
Absolutely. Also, what's so brilliant about that scene with Travolta and Uma Thurman when they dance in is it's just so much more effective than a love scene. You know, there's no sex scenes in Pulp Fiction. And, you know, there's a great thing saying, well, anybody can show a couple in bed, you know, but show them really connecting, and dance does that.
Yeah.
You know, that's what the old musicals used to do when you couldn't show sex scenes. And it's what Rocky does. You know, you don't really see Rocky and Adrian having sex, but you see them ice skating together and he's like holding her. Yeah. So it's like moments like that in a movie where
it's a show don't tell scenario.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's the subtext, which is amazing.
Now we're over to the last one,
right?
Which is the film you'd settle down with. This is like marriage. We're talking now. It could be your high school crush, which in your case, you literally married your high school crush. So one could always go back to that, or maybe in some cases you haven't met it yet, but curious whether there's like a film you can always come back to.
I know I'm going to change my mind, but the one that springs to mind, and I watched it again recently, and I absolutely love it, is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Okay.
So again, Tarantino.
We were talking about the book, Outside in the Lobby.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I love that film for so many reasons, because it's about the love of film.
Yeah.
It's about two buddies, which, you know, obviously I can relate to with Brett and I and our journey. And
it was all about the friendship. Anyone who looks at that film and goes like, I don't know what it was about. It was weird. Yeah. It's like, sometimes the idea of who Tarantino is bigger than what he actually produces.
Absolutely.
Like, I don't know what you were expecting. This is Tarantino. This is what he does.
And, you know, I think it's absolutely crucial that you know the whole backstory of what happens to Sharon Tate. There's a lot of people who saw that film.
That's an important part of it.
It's really important, because otherwise it seems very obscure and arbitrary. What I also love about it is the fairy tale that in the land of movies, things can sometimes work out. And he did that with Inglourious Bastards as well. You know,
we get to pummel Hitler with a machine gun.
Exactly, repeatedly.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like that's the magic of film. And Once Upon a Time, it's a fairy tale. So he just infused this most horrific thing that happened alongside these two buddies. And there's a line in it which I often think about, you know, when he describes his best friend, he says he's more than a brother but less than a wife. And, you know, when you've been on a journey with a pal, and it's just like the two of them watching movies and drinking beer. And I just love, a lot of people are like, oh, the movie's so long and Brad Pitt's just driving around in it. But it's like you're hanging out in this world with
these
guys.
This was not made for you.
No.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a special film. And I, on a trip to LA, ate at Musso and Frank's, which is where they do that meeting with Pacino in the beginning. Was the most expensive steak I've ever had in my life. And when you know, when you do the maths and you work out what sort of $40 is, you're like, Lord, this is expensive. But it was a really good steak. But a lot of that old Hollywood comes through, and it's still there in that place. And then, of course, shout out to the book, which if someone hasn't read or doesn't know it exists, It's very much worth your time to read.
Yeah, it's great.
Because I think he writes these kind of character biographies for his actors, and so he basically writes a book when he makes a movie. And of course, there's the TV show that Leonardo DiCaprio stars in, which was called Bounty Law. And in this book, he fleshes out basically the whole plot of this TV show, which, as we said before we got started, could have even been a book in itself.
Yeah.
It's been so well thought out.
It's brilliant.
And he understands that kind of TV show so well that all of that comes through.
Yeah. What we also love, and Brett and I spoke about it many times, about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, is the movies within a movie and the TV shows within a TV show.
Mm.
And it's such fun. And, you know, he does that with all of the movies that DiCaprio's in. They went off and shot Bounty Law, and they shot the other movies that you see him in. And, you know, with Just Now Jeffrey, we've got... It's about a love of film, and it's about a love of stories. And we got a huge kick out of writing and scripting all the scenes that you see within movies within the movie.
Yeah, there's that sort of like American Terminator-esque
movie. Yeah, there's the Rise of the Robots, which is...
Which you guys had to go off and shoot.
Yeah, we scripted. And also, there's... Well, there are four. There's American Aliens, which is Jeffrey's sort of go-to movie when he wants to, you know, have alone time.
Yeah.
There's Biff. Biff Shows His Stuff, which is an interracial sort of soft porn movie that's getting banned at the censorship board.
Yeah, that was great.
Which we scripted and shot. And again, we overwrote. There's Sexness, which is the controversial porno that they, you know, have
that
to deal
the whole
with.
Movie kind of centers around.
And then there's the robots one.
Just a quick tangent and side note, why it's such a strange name, Biff Shows His Stuff, is because Hilton and I, once on a holiday in Umhlanga, we created a stop frame little movie with a pen and some index cards.
Yeah.
And it was called, we named it Biff Shows His Stuff. So we had to find a way of putting one of our first movies back into it.
Biff could also be a bit of a Back to the Future nod.
Exactly.
Yeah. Lovely, guys. I loved it. I enjoyed the fact that not only was it something true to yourselves, in the sense that it was about Joburg in the 80s in South Africa. It's also just, it was fun. And I just think we always need comedy in our lives.
We do.
So thanks for bringing that joy. And I think best of luck for the film itself. And it would be lovely to get it on the Bioscope. So we'll keep in touch about that.
I'd love to.
But I think it's just, once again, about it coming back to it being this passion project. I think it's so great that not only did you get it made, but it's like, it's, you know, it's there. It exists. It exists now. And just well done on getting it made.
Thanks.
Because, you know, you didn't do it for the money. It wasn't about, it was just out of the pure itch to get it done, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've been saying since we were kids, we're going to make a movie together. We're going to make a movie together. And we came close. We wrote a script. I was still living in London and Brett was here. We wrote a movie called Joburg.
Okay.
And it was actually initially called Poiki Kosine Pressure Cooker.
Pressure Cooker, yeah.
And it was inspired by like a Pulp Fiction Shortcuts. Remember Raymond?
Yeah.
Robert Altman's movie Shortcuts. So it was a whole lot of intertwining narratives set in Joburg in the 90s. And we did come close, but then we kind of didn't get it off the ground and... We both went off on our own careers and we've always got to make a movie. And then kind of got to the point where...
When?
We had to do
it. And do you feel at this point the friendship is stronger? Did the movie bring you together? It's still too early to tell.
No, it's amazing. You know, Hilton and I have kind of got, you know, so much history that I think, you know, we've got almost a second...
Was it a working history?
Yeah, I mean,
you know, Brett's very tolerant.
do you make a lot of the stuff that comes out of the agency? Like, have you worked together on commercials?
We did a lot of commercial projects together.
No, then that's fine because.
But the point was that kind of stuff was work. I think, in some sense, we've been creating stories together, even though we weren't thinking about films since we were 12.
Yeah.
You know, you had to make up stories on the fly to save your butt many times, and we were very good at that. So there's a kind of a layer of language that we've spoken, I guess, for many years. Working in a team is not easy, but I think we, because we know each other so well,
Yeah.
We were able to, you know, find those amazing stories.
Lovely, man.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, guys, at this point, best of luck with everything.
Thank you.
And I hope all the distribution and the business side of your baby is everything that you want it to be. But either way, you've made it. You've got this for you. You know,
it exists.
And it's for you. Like, if it's true to you and it's something that you love, then, you know, then that can resonate. Well, it's the same with music. It's like this last album that our band did, we weren't as busy or proactively trying to be the world's biggest band. So this last album was very much for us.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, Brett, I kept saying, we're making this movie for us.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people say, will people overseas get it? You know, will it be understood? You know, the Jewish stuff, the Afrikaans stuff, the 80s. I'm like, we're making our movie. We want to watch it. We're the audience. And we sat on set every day at VT laughing and loving every single second of it.
Yeah.
And
I mean, it's actually maybe to emphasize that point, and we talked about it at the start. You know, I shudder to think that actually when we set out on this journey and some of our investors said, you know, maybe we should Americanize this film and make it more marketable. And we realized that, you know, we've got to make something that we love. And every decision you make along the way, you make it because you think that's going to make the film better.
Mm.
And that's the only way to do it.
Yeah.
Because if you're trying to make a film that somebody else thinks is going to be good, you know, you're on a road to nowhere.
No, I mean, second guessing.
Just to go back to all the films that you guys have mentioned along the way was just filled with people sticking to their guns.
Yeah.
You
know, if Stallone had compromised, if Tarantino tried to make a script that, you know, was more generic, it wouldn't be them. So
yeah, and I mean, we had plenty of doubt along the way, and it's actually one of Tarantino's sayings that I kept going back to, and he's like, if you really, really, really love movies, you can't make a bad one. And I really, really hope he's right.
No, lovely. You guys have made a great film, and it's fun, and I hope everyone gets to see it. And we'll do our best to perhaps time this episode the best way we can. But either way, today was a conversation about, you know, two guys like really just fulfilling their dreams and just making something for the pure fun and passion of it, which is the most important. So,
thanks.
Well done on that.
Thanks, Russell.
And
thank you. Thanks for having us, man.
Look forward to seeing where it all goes, and nice to be friends.
Yeah. Cool, man.
Thanks, guys.
See you at the movies.
See you at the movies.
Cheers. Cheers. All right. What a great chat. Great dudes. I learned something. I learned something from this chat, which I want to use better the next time we have two people on, two guests. We should get each guest to hype up the other one, because what happened is, and it happened more after the visit, is Hilton was explaining like just how established and great Brett is, because, you know, they're two buddies.
Yeah, for sure.
And so like it was so nice hearing someone more objectively praise the other one. And Brett was like, Hilton's a big deal, man. He's a commercials director that's made all these amazing things. And so I think the next time I do it, I must make sure that like I force like two partners or two business partners or two like collaborators to hype up each other.
That'd be cool.
It's the best way to like genuinely get
exactly.
like a good understanding of who they are.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, just now Jeffrey is in cinemas. Tickets are on sale at thebioscope.co.za. I think The Bioscope, being a cinema that plays so nicely on nostalgia, I think would be a good spot to come and watch the film. All right, and thank you for listening, guys. The home base is thevideostore.co.za. There's links to other guest chats at that website, and let us know what you think of this, man. And guys, we'll see you again soon.
Yeah.
All right.
Have fun.
Cool.
Ta-ta.
TTFN.
What?
TTFN.
Ta-ta for now.